The Guardian. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. He has in his hand a piece of paper. David Cameron lists his reform demands to Brussels as he calls for a new settlement ahead of the EU referendum. But just how new would it be and what would it change? Also this week, not kneeling, but bowing, and a very British coup. The head of the armed forces said he'd be worried if Jeremy Corbyn maintained his position on Trident and won the election. But how much should the military say about political decisions and political leadership? Joining me for all of this, we have a trio of Guardian columnists, Matthew D'Ancona, Raphael Baer and Natalie Nougaret. A warm welcome to you all.
The point I'm making is this. If the British Prime Minister was no longer present at European summits, we'd lose that voice and therefore permanently change our ability to get things done in the world. Now, we have every right to do that as a sovereign nation, but we should do so with our eyes open.
After months of touring Europe to see what he could get, David Cameron finally put his cards on the table this week in the game of high-stakes poker that he's playing with both EU leaders and his backbenchers. He wants an end to ever closer union, more European competitiveness, assurances for non-euro countries about the voting, and to restrict British benefits to new EU migrants. Is that it, is what the Tory Eurosceptics are saying? Raphael, Cameron said this was not mission impossible. Could we say that's the understatement of the week?
Well, it's certainly possible to get something that looks like the demands, you know, the outline of a deal that was set out in this letter that he wrote to the council president. And we know that because there have been enough hints on both sides as to what the broad outline of this thing would be in recent months. And so particularly this point about exemption from ever closer union. The Prime Minister's conference speech and indeed the Chancellor's conference speech this autumn, they both sort of made that the emblematic thing because it has this great symbolic value. And whereas a year, 18 months ago, I was hearing from diplomats on the other side of the channel that this was too symbolic. It seemed like such a gratuitously a sort of offensive thing to ask when it strikes at the heart of the European project. They're now saying, yes, of course we can find some compromise on that. And so there's also a recognition, of course, that David Cameron needs to be seen to fight some kind of battle and to have won. People are ready to do this on his terms. So he'll certainly come back with a deal. So the whole question is whether it's a deal that he can then plausibly sell to the country as sufficient change to justify all the undecided people saying, oh, go on then, let's stay in.
Matthew is a kind of seasoned Cameron chronicler. Back in 2013, when he first announced there was going to be the referendum at all, he did a similar thing to what he did this week. Big pro-European speech, but then I'm going to have to wager it all on a few demands here and there. Have his demands changed a lot over the months, or do you think he's about where he thought he always would be?
Well, I think he's tilt a little bit more in the direction of immigration, because potentially, very regrettably, there's a danger that the whole question of Britain's future in the EU will become conflated with and meshed into the question of immigration, which I think would be extremely regrettable and would lead to a referendum campaign that was very, very ugly. So it was interesting to note that he set a very high bar there of no benefits, no in-work benefits to EU migrants for 4 years, which sounds to me like a position from which he can negotiate down to a compromise, because I don't think he'll get 4 years, if anything. It's certainly become more simple. And I think that what you've got here is his attempt to say to the Eurosceptics in his own party, look, I understand the status quo is not to your liking, and I will do my best to deliver something which is better. But really, the sceptics, Bernard Jenkins and others, have already said you know, it's not enough. So in fact, we've already got to that point. This is an elaborate choreography we have to go through before we get to the vote itself. But we have to separate the negotiations from the politics of the referendum. They are different.
Natalie, how do you think people are thinking about this in other European capitals where, you know, between Greece and the migration crisis, there are quite a lot of other problems to grapple with at the moment?
Yes, indeed. I mean, on the continent, the view for quite a while has been, why is the UK, why is Cameron laying this problem at our doorstep? You know, why do we have to deal with this on top of everything else that we have to deal with? So there's been a lot of aggravation, and I don't think that this moment has completely dispelled that. We saw that with the early reaction from a European Commission spokesperson saying that the demand concerning migrants, benefits to migrants, immigrants were highly problematic. So we're getting those. But as you said, Matthew, maybe everybody can sort of back down, you know, inch their way into a compromise eventually. What was striking to me in the speech was really it said something fundamental about how the UK relates to the rest of the European project, because Cameron only made the case for what the UK should be getting out of this negotiation. He did not say anything that related to what an overall vision for Europe and what being together as 28 states, how that helps us become stronger or more efficient by being each separate entities.
Would he say, you know, that there's a business about a multi-currency union, so you have special rules so that the euro bloc, the big euro bloc, can't steamroll everyone else? And he might say, you know, there's a feeling across Europe that people don't think European institutions are in touch enough, so you have this, you know, this system for red cards, whatever they call it, so national parliaments can kind of gang up on Brussels in a way that they've not been able to do up till now. Don't you think some of those things might look popular elsewhere?
Yes, he will find some understanding, I would say, on the three first issues, which are the euro ins and outs, sovereignty parliaments, the language on ever closer union can be, remember the expression is ever closer union between the peoples. Everybody forgets
detail.
That between the peoples. You know. The migration issue will be the most problematic. But on the other points, I think something can be worked out. It will not be it will not be treaty change. There won't be a document in the run up to the British referendum saying now, you know, this is how we've changed the EU treaties to Cameron's satisfaction. That's not going to happen. I think basically what Cameron has to try to do, because he's pitching this, of course. He's dealing with EU leaders and institutions. That's one part of his interlocutors. But he has to pitch this to the British public. This is the main ground that he has to conquer on, and especially I think the undecided. And so I think he found a way to address that middle ground, I think, in that speech by not appearing too excessive in his demands, but at the same time saying that, you know, he would fight to the end to get a better deal. He has to give it's not so much the technicalities of the demands that he's putting through, I think. He has to create the impression in Britain and for British voters that the EU is listening.
I think it's quite interesting also in that respect that the sort of the top of the speech was all about security, and this is the sort of the wider strategic value that this partnership, our relationship with the European Union has. Now, of course, that's nothing to do with the renegotiation. That is the sort of macro argument for a sort of hard-headed judgment that overall Britain will be better off carrying on in the EU, even if at some sort of emotional level people find the whole thing a little bit distasteful. And that is the argument that is ultimately going to win the referendum, if indeed it's won by the Remain people. But it points to this quite interesting challenge that the Prime Minister has, because, as we've said, you know, he has pegged so much to the renegotiation. When he comes out of it, he is somehow going to fight this campaign that simultaneously says the terms of this deal that I've done are fundamental, they are transcendent, this is the thing that makes it worth staying in. But also, the renegotiation is kind of beside the point, because there is this much greater, bigger historical reason why ultimately we've got to win. And the people who have organising the Remain campaign are getting nervous because they recognise that ultimately it's David Cameron, it's the Prime Minister's personal campaigning weight and authority that is going to decide this for them. There's pretty much nothing else they can do apart from develop the arguments, try and discredit the Out campaign. But really, they're just waiting for Cameron to get into that kind, to roll up his sleeves and do that kind of campaigning magic-y thing that he did this May to deliver it for them. And they're worried that strategically, he's getting himself into a position that's going to make that harder, not easier for himself.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, I was talking to a member of the cabinet who's very much in favour of staying in.
And that narrows it down a bit.
This person's point was, how do we sell these abstractions on the doorstep? You know, Farage and Co. will be selling very ugly populist politics. How do we say in counter to that? Oh, don't worry, because we'll have different rules for the nine member states that are outside the single currency. Have no fear. In fact, what will happen, and I think it goes back to the point about security, is that it will regrettably be a battle between two forms of fear. It will be a battle between a rather ugly fear of migration and a fear of being left out of the club. And I think that's right, that the weight on Cameron's campaigning shoulders now is immense, particularly as we don't know who he's up against, because the crucial figure in all of this, of course, is Boris Johnson and which way he decides to go.
And perhaps Theresa May?
Or perhaps Theresa May.
I mean, it does look like if you, as everyone will be in the Conservative Party, looking towards who the next leader is going to be.
Absolutely.
Cameron said he's not there. There's a space there, isn't there, for one big figure.
It's richly entangled, and I think Boris's speech at the conference was, again, very coquettish and hinting that, in his view, population mobility should be decided in this country and not by the EU. Well, we know that's not going to happen. I mean, the population mobility is so etched into the European project. That's not deliverable. So, by implication, Boris is saying that he will be on the outside, but there's a lot of water to go before we get to that bridge.
Playing hard to get at the very least. Natalie.
I just wanted to add that, when we speak about the migration issue being the most problematic, it's not, I mean, I think we should try to make it clear to people. This is not about Cameron stopping the EU from flooding the UK with migrants. It will be pitched to some people that way, but that's not what the case is. The case is, what his demand says is 4 years before you can get in-work benefits. This introduces a discrimination among EU citizens. That's the key thing. It's not so much about numbers of migrants coming in. It's about how the EU preserves the notion that all its citizens are equal.
I mean, it'd be quite odd politically, wouldn't it, if the way that he does this in the end is to say no one can have tax credits until they're, been paying national insurance for several years, which might mean a lot of British citizens have to wait into their mid-20s as well. I mean, that could be a gift for UKIP, couldn't it?
Well, the thing is, that's the way that he meets the manifesto pledge, because remember, this is something that he sort of promised to do regardless of the renegotiation. And so that is that sort of essentially saying you make your in-work benefits depend on national insurance contributions after a fixed period is the device by which you can do that regardless of what happens in the renegotiation. I mean, ultimately, I think there is more or less nothing that David Cameron can get out of the European negotiation that will satisfy people who think that at some level free movement is a kind of corroding sovereignty, control, identity, all those issues. And yet, as sort of Matt just sort of said, the argument in favour becomes very abstract about labour mobility, about the lump of labour fallacy and creation of demand. I mean, all the good liberal arguments for open borders are not easily packaged up on the doorstep, to put it.
Can we just have a word on timing? This week we've been hearing stuff about maybe as early as June 2016. Raf, you're always good on these process things. Do you think that's plausible?
Well, I mean, I've given up guessing when it's going to be, because you hear different things from different people. I mean, clearly there was a feeling not that long ago, and Matt will know better than me on this, that to get it done as quickly as possible for a number of reasons. First, David Cameron wants to serve a full second term, and it's very hard to do anything else while this is the dominant thing in his life. I mean, someone said to me the Downing Street diary is now blocked out for the next 6 to 8 weeks with just the word Europe written across every page. It is, and they, you know, that's not why he came into politics. It's not what he wants to do. You also have French and German elections, very important elections, which would make 2017 much more problematic. You have the British presidency, rotating presidency of the council in 2017. There are so many reasons to try and just get this thing out of the way. And finally, also, the deeper you get into midterm, the more likely it is that people will take a referendum as just an opportunity to say, to answer the question, do you or do you not like the Prime Minister and the government? And how much do you want to hurt David Cameron? And the answer, the further you get into this parliament, will be a lot. So that's why I think they want to get it done quickly. But they have to have a deal.
I mean, this is the problem, though, isn't it? There's lots of arguments here, Matt, for going as soon as you can. Yes. But, like, if they're, you know, picking a fight with Poland over tax credits or whatever it is, Poland's not got the same incentive to settle early. And there's some issue around voting rights for 16 and 17-year-olds, where I gather...
That's right, which will take even longer. I think that the problem here is that no substantial deal is deliverable in any of the time frames we're talking about. So I think that what he will want to get is what in the Northern Ireland peace deal was called the heads of agreement, which is a sort of basic bullet points of, you know, where the final sort of agreement will be, and then get going immediately on that. Because the truth is that this will not be resolved by the terms of the deal. It's quite clear that the Tory right are going to oppose this. This is their moment. I mean, they have been working towards this since John Major and possibly before, and they want to grab it for all it's worth. They're not going to say, oh, okay, you know, you've done a really good job, David. We decommission our arms. It's not going to happen. So in some ways, the sooner the better, from his point of view.
And do you think it will, do you think with some heads of agreement type fudge or something, even if he hasn't got everything sorted, that it might be realistic to go for next summer?
I would go for next summer, because I think that for the reasons Raf explained, I mean, that he doesn't want it to be a referendum on himself. And the further we get away from the May surprise victory, the closer we get to the midterm I hate the government referendum. It's obviously worse for him. He should, you know, the sooner it is remotely possible, he should go for it.
But this is clearly a high wire act as well. I mean, the timing is, you know, Cameron has left it to the last minute basically to put send this letter to Donald Tusk, the head of the European Council, etc. And there's a summit mid December where Britain will be getting, you know, feedback and answers from EU colleagues. But the timing is really tight. And remember, last time Cameron was supposed to pitch something to fellow EU leaders, the migrant crisis was so huge that there was only 10 minutes left. This was sometime before the summer, in the summer. There was only 10 minutes left to actually discuss the risk of Brexit among EU leaders. So, you know, let's hope that in December when they meet, there won't be something else, some huge issue popping up and taking all the energy out of that discussion with Britain.
Finally, Natalie, on the way it's going down in other countries again, and Marine Le Pen has welcomed this letter, hasn't she?
Well, Marine Le Pen is basically, you know, for this dismantling of the euro. She doesn't like the EU, so she will welcome anything that she can exploit in terms of just, you know, casting the EU as an entity that infringes on national sovereignty. And she will play alongside Farage in this whole renegotiation process as much as she can. And it'll be interesting to see how that, because her party is growing, unfortunately, and there are regional elections in France in December, which will be a big test for Hollande. And it'll be interesting to see how her pressure, the pressure coming from Marine Le Pen, might or not weigh on Hollande's reaction to Cameron's negotiation tactics.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Now, anyone watching the historic elections in Myanmar this week will know all too well the malign effects of an overbearing military on democracy. What people in Britain are not used to, though, is their armed forces chiefs sounding off over not just policy, but actually politics too.
The whole thing about deterrence rests on the credibility of its use. When people say you're never going to use the deterrent, what I say is you use the deterrent, you know, every second of every minute of every day. And the purpose of the deterrent is that you don't have to use it because you successfully deter.
Raphael, even if that statement about the general's worry had some military logic, did you think he was entitled to wear it while he was still in uniform?
Certainly, I mean, I feel uncomfortable about this, and regular listeners to this podcast will know that I wasn't exactly persuaded of the wisdom of making Jeremy Corbyn the leader of the Labour Party, so I can say this from a pretty non-partisan point of view. I just feel it's not quite the same as, for example, the chairman of an NHS trust saying, you know, well, I'd be worried about the future of the health service under such and such a fiscal trajectory, or, you know, the head of the National Theatre saying we must preserve our arts funding. I mean, the man's, you know, he has guns, and that really does change the nature of his role in the sort of coercive state, and therefore simply shouldn't express any kind of preference as to who is prime minister. And ultimately, that is kind of what he was doing. Then there's a sort of another tier to that, which is that ultimately it just sort of feeds this feedback loop by which the Jeremy Corbyn supporters and the Labour Party feel and almost embrace this sense of victimisation by the establishment, and the sense that absolutely everyone is lining up to get them, and that just vindicates their project because it demonstrates how subversive and radical it is. And just from the Labour Party's point of view, that's just not a very healthy place for them to get to. So all in all, I thought it was a pretty bad episode.
I mean, the thing that was unusual in this intervention, Matt, I thought, was that it sort of went beyond the do we need an aircraft carrier before we attempt such and such an operation to being pretty much, is this man fit to be Prime Minister, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, I never have been in favour of the CDS, the Chief of Defence Staff, being a public figure. They can, I suppose, give testimony to select committees. That's one thing. But going on television shows and talking about policy issues is not something I think they should do. You know, ministers decide, advisers advise, and much as soldiers may not like to be described as advisors, they are actually when it comes to these kind of decisions. And I personally would keep Trident. I'm a big believer in the deterrent, but I don't believe in the guys with the guns going on television and saying he's not fit to be Prime Minister because he disagrees with the doctrine that held the peace in Europe for 40 years. And I think what's astonishing really is in a political world that is so tightly controlled, in which there are so many protocols, that this is considered okay. There was a lot of friction between David Richardson and Cameron over various things, and it came out in David Richardson's book, and there it is. Famously, Cameron said, you know, you do the fighting, I'll do the talking. And it's perhaps a rather rude way of putting it, but it's actually about right. He's entitled to say these things, and he would be entitled to say them to Corbyn if Corbyn was elected Prime Minister. But I'm not sure he's entitled to say it on the Andrew Marr show.
So you'd sort of want to see him almost in a civil servant, you know.
I think as in his current role, he is a civil servant.
Mm.
He is an advisor to whoever forms the civil government. And long may that continue.
Natalie, I mean, it's something that varies a lot around the world, isn't it? How far the military are allowed to have a view that's distinct?
Yes, I mean, in my country, France, you know, certainly there's a pretty dire, dark history of the military overstepping their prerogatives and moving on to the political field. I mean, there was a military putsch, you know, an attempted coup in the 60s, in the early 60s. That was during the Algerian War. That's just to frame the French mindset on that. But I think it also point. I mean, I think it's really interesting that this debate happened on what a military figure can say in this country, in the UK, on political issues. But it also points to you know, at the same time, we want them to respect certain rules, the neutrality of the military. But at the same time, we're very much in a society where each and every official figure is pressed to, you know, to talk, to reach out to the media. We want them to engage. We want them to answer our questions. And so, you know, how do you square that?
I mean, that is a good point, isn't it, Matt? There is a sort of feeling that the way the world is going is that more people are becoming public figures. You know, you think a generation ago, MI5 was still secret. Now its head will give speeches. And right across the board, we expect people to be more what we call accountable. But you're saying maybe more people should shut up.
Well, I think that accountability goes, you know, I'm old-fashioned in this respect, that I think the accountability goes via the Prime Minister, via Parliament. You know, I don't think it goes via a general sitting on a couch in the BBC. I think it would be dangerous if we confuse transparency, which is obviously a good thing, with the desire, and freedom of information legislation, which is a good thing, with the desire to have every single public official sitting, talking freely on a couch, you know, in every chat show. I'm not sure that's a healthy way to govern.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, this actually ties back to the conversation we were having a moment ago about Europe, because there are going to be a lot of people with some quite strong opinions about what the outcome of the European referendum should be, and we don't really have clear rules of engagement on this. I mean, we had saw the governor of the Bank of England essentially expressing a view. I mean, we saw in the referendum over Scottish independence that any time anyone says anything, if it's endorsing the view of, you know, one side or the other, the opponents will cry foul, and that's going to happen a lot now in the next 6 to 8 months.
But just one point on what the general said. I mean, on TV, I think it also pointed to the fact that Jeremy Corbyn's statement on Trident was something of an absurdity, I would say, because, you know, either as a political leader, he decides to cancel British deterrence and to, you know, get it completely off the table, or, you know, stop British nuclear deterrence. Or it exists, and he's had to, you know, and he's a leader and has that as a tool. But you don't say, "I will never use it." I mean, that
problem is he's been saying that for 40 years, hasn't he? So I'm not sure he can credibly unsay it either.
Which makes this particular sentence, and it was noticed outside the UK, it made him look like a maverick.
I mean, I will say this for it, which is that we seem to be agreed that the general was acting, you know, beyond what his proper constitutional remit is or should be. But it is interesting, and it is a sign of the, you know, depending on where you stand, thrilling or scary times in which we live, that Corbyn is raising issues that have really been considered put to bed. I mean, it's a long time, many, you know, decades since a mainstream party leader questioned the deterrence doctrine, and he's doing that. So there are some huge issues now suddenly thrown back into the Westminster and media milieu.
It's interesting, isn't it, though, that the issues are kind of, as you say, like live for the first time in many years, but there's a great deal still going on about political form, isn't there? I mean, the newspapers this week were talking about the angle that Jeremy was or wasn't leaning out at the cenotaph, whether that was sufficiently respectful, and now he's had to take up with the Privy Council while insisting kneeling.
I suppose one of the things that happened was that there was a period when a lot of politics gathered around the centre, and because so many people claimed they're all the same, the differences between them all became almost aesthetic. So the bow, you know, the angle at which you bow, which quite frankly is, as far as I'm concerned, a matter between Jeremy Corbyn and his conscience. I don't think it's a huge national issue. It does become a matter of, you know, seething public debate. It's slightly absurd.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing, you know, nod of the head, bend of the knee to the Queen. We had Jeremy Corbyn doing incy-wincy spider hands yesterday. I mean, it's like some horrible sort of dance craze or political agadoo. I mean, I find the whole thing quite vacuous, to be honest. But again, I'm going to defend Jeremy Corbyn for a second time in one podcast. But also, there is something slightly unpleasant about essentially this man standing up and saying, well, I have this set of principles, and this is what I believe, and therefore I'm going to do it differently. And more or less, a lot of newspapers and some other people bullying him, you know, literally frog-marching him to the Queen, making him bend his knee, making him tilt his head, and then, you know, if he doesn't do it enough, doing it the right way. You know, as I say, I mean, I'm in print as saying how bad an idea I thought it would be to make Jeremy Corbyn leader of the Labour Party for all sorts of reasons. But this whole spectacle I find quite distasteful.
Can you just give us a second, Raph, as a final thought on where we're up to with Corbyn's shadow cabinet and message discipline? It's a rolling story we keep coming back to, but what's the latest?
The top line at the moment is that at the shadow cabinet meeting earlier this week, Jeremy Corbyn said, invited his shadow cabinet to show a little bit more old-fashioned message discipline and to perhaps consider agreeing or consulting with the leader's office before opening their mouths. This is entirely normal practice in what we used to call the old politics, but it's considered faintly absurd coming from the man who has built his entire political career out of defying the whips and showing no interest in message discipline at all. And it just goes to show this extraordinary, fascinating learning curve that Corbyn is on, from being essentially a lone wolf maverick campaigner, answerable to no one but his conscience, to essentially a manager with a team running a project. He's never done it before. He's learning on the job. And the interesting thing is he is sort of incrementally probably getting a bit better at it. And
Raph, this is the third time now that you're saying something polite about Corbyn. I've never seen the like.
I'm struck by conversations with a lot of Labour MPs who don't like Jeremy Corbyn in the last few weeks, who are saying they no longer expect the whole thing to implode quite quickly. The feeling is that he's there for a while, he's quite enjoying it. They don't think he'll be, I mean, by getting better, I don't mean he's coming anywhere closer to making the Labour Party something that Britain as a whole would elect to form a government, but I mean he's getting better at it in the way that he's getting harder to remove.
Okay, Natalie, quick.
Just to link up to our first topic, which was the EU, I mean, I think Corbyn did get one thing right since he became leader of the Labour Party, which is he's shifted on the EU, right? I mean, it happened in September, but he did shift. He was a strong Eurosceptic, and he has said that he would, you know, be in favour of the UK staying in the EU, and I think that's an important message, that's a learning curve as well.
Okay, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Natalie, to Matthew and to Raphael. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design, so you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.